Okay, we are live and we back for Kuji Chagulia Mentality Part 2. I named this one High John the Conqueror because that's a story that we're going to get into. But welcome to my own shows, my own The Shoulders of Giants channel. I am Joseph Ward, the founder and creator of On the Shoulders of Giants, also the author. We got going on with On the Shoulders of Giants. Once again, patreon.com/OTSOG, as well as www.ontheshoulders1.com. So here's my website that you can check it out. And I got all types of information. You can check out my nonprofit information. You can also get an On the Shoulders of Giants app. I got an app that you can get for your Android. I got iPhone coming soon. I got the iPhone app coming soon, but we got the Android going on right now, so make sure you check that out. And then you can also support me on Patreon at patreon.com/OTSOG. I actually have a online course on Patreon right now, so I got more coming soon and a lot more exclusive Patreon content. So some of these conversations here gonna be moved to Patreon, so you know it's for the special stuff, for the special people. So make sure y'all check it out. And welcome to everybody who coming in. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Make sure you share this. Tell a friend to tell a friend to tell a friend. Share this broadcast here. Smash that subscribe button. Smash that like button. Make sure you comment. And we're about to get this thing going on because I got Baba Olusegun back in the building for Kuji Chagulia Mentality Part 2. And we're about to get it in. So how you doing today, Baba?
Hello.
Hello. Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. How about you?
Everything is good on my end. Happy to be here. I'm excited because I know we got some good stuff to go in. So I'm gonna continue to welcome people in. So y'all make sure y'all come on in because it's gonna be a good one. A lot of people say they like the first one. I got a lot of comments. A lot of good feedback from my first session. So of course, you know, the internet tripping. We always technology, but that's why we want to make sure we bring it back for part two, because you left off in the when you was given a good story about your life, so you left off there. But I know you got some things you want to clear up, so I'm gonna go ahead and shut my mouth and let you get started. But I do want to say this: if anybody have any comments, if you got any comments, put your comments in the comment section, and we'll make sure that we get to your comments and get your questions and things answered. If you got questions, ask them, put them in the comment box. But once again, Babu Olusegun, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. First, I want to clear up some misinformation I gave out in part one. When okay. I was talking about the Dismal Swamp, I misidentified the location.
Okay.
I'm not going to give the incorrect location. I'm just going to tell you the correct location.
Okay.
Great Dismal Swamp straddles the border between North Carolina and Virginia. North Carolina and Virginia. It's very near Norfolk, Virginia. The James River that flows from Richmond out to the Atlantic Ocean runs just north of the northern boundary of the Dismal Swamp.
Okay.
Near Norfolk. Okay, just wanted to clear that up.
All right.
So last time I was getting into a story from my own life. Mm-hmm. I was growing up in Atlanta, Georgia. I think I mentioned that in Atlanta, my father was basically the equivalent of Reverend C.K. Steele in Tallahassee.
Right.
As a matter of fact, the two of them were classmates, and both of them were vice presidents of Dr. King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Right.
So this is around 1967. I turned 21 that year. I don't remember if this was before or after my birthday, but in 67, that's the year I turned 21. my father had gone out to a meeting, and I was at home with my stepmother, and the phone rang. And a voice of a very distinct Southern drawl asked to speak to my dad. So I said, well, he's not in right now. May I take a message? And they asked me if I was his son.
Right.
I said, yes, I'm his son. May I take a message? They said, yeah, we're getting ready to come over there and rape your mother. That's what they said, right? Now, okay. I'm assuming that they thought that that was going to get some excitement out of me.
Mm-hmm.
But I just responded with, okay, come on over. I'll be here when you get here.
Right.
And I went and got my gun, one my father gave me when I was 8 years old, right? Not so I could shoot up the neighborhood, not so I could have drive by with the guys across town, none of that. We went hunting, and we used it to protect the home, right? So I went and got my gun, got a chair, and I sat down right beside the front door. Almost shot my dad when he came home until I realized he had keys. He had keys in the lock, you know?
Right.
When I heard that, I was like, oh, that's dad coming home. But I was, you know, when I heard the footsteps and all that, I was...
He was ready.
I was like, hey, let's get it on. You know? But they never showed up. And I think my reaction was what deterred them, because I didn't get all hysterical like, oh my God,
right?
I'll be here when you get here, homie, come on. You might get me, but I'm taking two of you with me.
Right.
You know, yeah, that was my mentality. You know, I shun violence, but I've never been the classical nonviolent. You know, if you don't start nothing, it won't be nothing.
Right.
That's how I look at it. But if you're going to start something, I have every right and I will exercise every means at my disposal to defend myself.
And you should. You
know, right. Exactly. You know, my dad used to say, your rights end where my nose begins. You know, like, you say what you want to say, what you want to do over there. And when you start encroaching on my space, we got a problem.
We got a problem.
Yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to tell that story.
Okay.
You know, that's from my own life experience. It was terrorism back then. You know,
yeah.
Coming home from anywhere after dark, you know, you have to sit in the car for a minute and kind of observe what's going on outside. You know, then when you get out of the car, you're constantly, you know, checking until you get safely inside.
You know, right.
It was like that in the days, right? So anyway, on to the next topic. I think I wanted to say something about, I think it was Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Not so much to describe the association, but to tell you about a circumstance that occurred between representatives of the UNIA.
Mm-hmm.
And the government of Liberia in West Africa, right? Now, most people know that Garvey had a concept of going back to Africa, you know, repatriation.
Right, right,
right. So in 1921, he sent a delegation to Monrovia to meet with representatives of the president of Liberia to negotiate the purchase of the land and so forth and so forth, sign some agreements and stuff. Right. That was in 1921. However, because two things were going on. First of all, Garvey was under investigation by the FBI, well, it wasn't called the FBI then. It's called Special Investigations Unit in the Department of Justice. And MI5, the British counterpart to the FBI.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Because Garvey was a Jamaican citizen who was part of the British colonial empire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both of these people were interested in him because Garvey's organization was global.
Okay.
See, when we talk about right. Martin Luther King, his organization never was as large as Garvey's.
Nah.
Garvey's organization was global. he had a newspaper that people used to smuggle, you know, like guys working on merchant ships and stuff like that. He used to smuggle his newspaper into different countries in the Caribbean and Africa and whatnot, you know. So he had a Kuji Chagu Lia plan.
He did.
He even had a meeting with the Ku Klux Klan
to discuss the issue.
How can we get away from each other?
Right.
You know? Yeah. So he's under investigation, right? So the United States government and the British government began to put pressure on the government of Liberia to renege on the agreements they made with Marcus Garvey. Right now, the fact that it was going on in the Congo, right?
Mm-hmm.
In 1880, the European powers dissected Africa and everybody got a piece.
Right. Yeah.
Belgium is one of the smallest countries in Europe and they got one of the largest colonies in Africa, the Congo. It's called the Belgium Congo.
Right.
Right. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the writer Joseph Conrad, but he wrote a story called Heart of Darkness.
The name sounds familiar.
Yeah, they teach it in college classes and whatnot. If you saw the movie Apocalypse Now, it's based on that same story, but except it takes place in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, right? But in the time frame that Conrad wrote it, it was when the Belgian Congo, under King Leopold of Belgium, was killing elephants and taking the ivory out of the Congo, right? And then all of a sudden in 1898, this guy named Dunlap up in Scotland somewhere figures out, he's trying to figure out a way to make the tires on his daughter's bicycle, you know, flex so they don't have to have springs on the bicycle.
Right.
He comes up with this idea of galvanized rubber, some rubber that'll stretch, you can blow it up, and it's cushioning, right? So all of a sudden, bicycles become extremely popular. Everybody wants to ride a bicycle. As a matter of fact, in 1898, there was an African-American guy, they called him Major Taylor. He was a world champion bicycle racer in 1898. As far as I know, he was the first African-American world champion of anything.
Right.
Jack Johnson came later. The boxer came later, right? Major Taylor. He's well-known over Europe because that's where bicycle racing was very popular, right? But anyway, so all this bicycle stuff is going on. All of a sudden, the car, automobile gets invented. You've got to have wheels, you know.
Yeah.
So Leopold found out that there were rubber vines
in the Congo,
in the jungle in the Congo, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here's the deal: if you tap a rubber vine, it kills it.
Right.
You don't get to hit it but one time, right? And Firestone Rubber Company, and in the midst of all the stuff that's going on with Garvey and Liberia, Firestone Rubber Company slips in undercover and purchases the land that had been promised to Marcus Garvey, and they built a rubber plantation on it.
Wow.
They planted rubber trees. Now here's the distinction. You tap a rubber vine, it dies. If you tap a rubber tree, it doesn't die. You can come back next year and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Leopold, understanding the economic dynamics of what's getting ready to happen, he's getting ready to get put out of business. So he establishes a quota on how much rubber sap he's got these slaves in Africa. He's got a quota for how much of that stuff they have to bring out. And if they don't bring out their quota, he's subject to cut their hands off. Right? He was just I got a book. It's called King Leopold's Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show it. This is it right here. Adam Hochschild. Okay. King Leopold's Ghost. Tells the whole dynamic of this stuff going on in the Congo. There's a picture in this book. I'm not going to show it to you because it's too hard. Of a man looking at the severed hand and foot of his 5-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to take, man.
Yeah.
That's hard to take. That's what was going on. And Garvey got undercut.
made me think about the book by, I think it was Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, and to kind of get into that whole annexation of Africa. And Leopold and them and his crew were some of the first to come in and kind of colonize the Africans to be able to exploit them for the resources in those days. And it's crazy how I always, ever since I was in like middle school and elementary school, when they would teach us history, they would always talk bad about Hitler, like, and it's rightfully so. We all know what Hitler did, but they would be praising people like Leopold and praising people like Alexander. And I'm sitting, you know, I'm a young person. I ain't the smartest in the world at that time, but I'm like, okay, you all are saying that this man is evil for doing this, but you all are saying that these other people are good for doing this. It don't add up. So I saw some of the hypocrisy in it, but then as I got older, I kind of understood those who contributed to the economic growth of white supremacy around the world, those are the ones that get praised.
Yeah, see, when you start talking about, you know, the white supremacist mindset, they never considered us as human.
Right.
You know, and sometimes, I guess some of them still don't. You know, you have to dehumanize somebody to do these horrendous things that they did to us.
Right. Right.
You, there's some kind of something inside everybody that says you can't do that to somebody that's like yourself. You know,
right.
You can't do that to somebody that looks like you or something. So, you know, they use the color of our skin to say that we don't look like them. The reality of it is they don't look like us.
Right.
Yeah, they the ones that lost something. Right.
Right.
They don't look like us. But what's the capital of the European Union?
The capital of the EU?
Yes.
I want to say Britain, but then they pull out.
Britain got out, right?
Is it Scotland now?
Nope.
Belgium.
We've already been talking about it. It's Brussels, Belgium.
Right. Okay. Right. Belgium.
One of the smallest countries in Europe has a capital of the European Union. You know.
Yeah. It's.
The British are so arrogant, you know, that they like, yeah, we don't want no part of that, you know.
Right.
But hey, how about this? Queen Elizabeth, she's part of the Habsburg dynasty. What's the name Habsburg?
Habsburg?
Habsburg. Sound kind of German, don't it?
Yeah, it does.
Uh-huh.
Well, right. Yeah. Well, you know, they got those lineages. They got them, them old that go back.
Yes, sir. They
Saxons, because before it was Anglo-Saxon. Anglos and the Saxons, two different types of tribes, two different warring tribes. And then you got these people with these lineages that go back to the foundation of these different European nations. So. Yeah, it's all familiar with them, and they pass these things down from family member to family member. No matter if you second cousin, 17th cousin, you're still in the family.
Exactly. That's I don't know. That's frowned upon. You know, that kind of procreation amongst close relatives like that is highly frowned upon.
Yeah.
So let me tell you about another thing. Well, it still got to do with Garvey, but it also involves my personal experience, right? When Garvey formed the Black Star Line, steamship, right? And a lot of what got him in trouble was that he left the country one time to go to Jamaica for some reason, and they wouldn't let him back in.
Right.
And so while he was out of the country, some unscrupulous people started messing up things inside the office, you know, at the UNIA. Quiet as it's kept, the FBI has always been an equal opportunity employer. The very first FBI agent ever was a guy who was sent to infiltrate Garvey's organization. They pulled J. Edgar Hoover up out of the basement of the Justice Department, put him in charge of what they call the Special Investigations Unit, which evolved into the FBI. Now, this guy they sent to infiltrate Garvey, there's some documents, you know, some of his reports, but he used a code name. He didn't use a name. It was some numbers and letters or something, you know, just identifying, like a password or something. But, right. But you know, Garvey, and this happened to a lot of leaders, Malcolm, right, got infiltrated. That COINTELPRO thing was prolific.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
I worked with a theater company in Miami. I'm one of the co-founders. Called the M Ensemble Company. Mm-hmm. And in 1973, we formed in 1971, so we were still trying to get off the ground, right?
Right.
But a sister who had a building had a large space and she gave it to us to use as a theater. So we, you know, set it up like a theater. One day this guy shows up. He's very enthusiastic and wants to really get involved. And we're like, dude, you know, show up tomorrow at 7. We'll be here. You just got to show up. We got something for you to do. For 5 days, this guy was Johnny on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
He was diligent for 5 days, and then he vanished. He just flat disappeared, right?
Right.
At that time, Assata Shakur was on the run. They were trying to track her down, the FBI, mm-hmm. right? The next time I saw this brother's face was in a photograph of Assata Shakur being carried away in handcuffs by the arresting officers, and one of them was this brother who had passed through our theater company.
Yeah.
COINTELPRO to the bone. Right.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to Garvey. One of the heroes of the Cuban Revolution, the 10 Years' War from 1868 and from the Spanish-American War in 1895 to 1898, was a man named Antonio Maceo.
Okay.
That name, Maceo, M-A-C-E-O, if you're familiar with James Brown and his band, he was always saying, Maceo, hit me.
Yeah.
Right? M-A-C-E-O. And I'm like, where did that name come from? Then when I saw Antonio in Spanish, it's Maceo, right?
Okay.
So this guy was very well known in the diaspora as being a champion of abolition of slavery, you know, one of the fiercest fighters in the Cuban army. So Garvey, in one of the ships he bought for the Black Star Line, he named after Antonio Maceo.
Okay.
So I'm reading... you know, I've been my first trip to Cuba, well, not my first trip, my second and third trips to Cuba were for the purpose of tracking down some stuff on Antonio Maceo. You know, I got books. Like, he was a bad dude, right? He got shot 23 times before they killed him.
Wow. Okay.
Bad dude, right? So anyway, I'm reading about this ship, Antonio Maceo, and the Philosophy and Opinions of Marcus Garvey. There's a picture of it, and it says that it is now docked at a port called Antilla, A-N-T-I-L-L-A, Antilla, Cuba.
Okay.
Okay. I was like, what? The date given was 1925, right? So mm-hmm. 2003, I was able to rent a car when I was in Cuba. I drove from Havana to Antilla. I'm going mm-hmm. on a hunt. It's ship, right? I'm going to see if it's still there. So I get there, get to the dock, and there's no ships and nobody at the dock. I'm looking around. I'm waiting around. I thought, you know, maybe it's lunchtime. Somebody show up in a minute. I hung around for about 30 minutes. I'm like, nah, this is not working. So.
Right.
I finally did see somebody, and I was like, you know, I'm looking for some information about a ship that used to be here. And they said, we got to go into town and talk to the people at the maritime office. So I drove into town, found the office. I get out, I walk in, and they're having a meeting inside. So, you know, I excuse myself in my best broken Spanish. I tried to state my business.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy says, you know, wait just a few minutes. He says, just wait outside. I'll call you because we'll be through in just a minute. So I went outside. He comes out. First thing he asks me, he says, you want a drink? I said, rum? He said, yeah. I said, most definitely. That's it. Let's do it, right? So we start talking about all the super boys rum. So I get to telling him why I'm there. You know, I'm looking for this ship. Long to the Black Star Line. Marcus Garvey is very important to the history of African Americans. The guy interrupted me and he says, you know, we're African Americans too. I said, you know what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, I'm going to have to go with that, right?
Right.
So
right.
There was no, but he didn't know anything about the ship.
Right.
So I told him, I said, well, last information I got is 1925. So he goes and gets me the oldest man in town. This man was 75 years old, maybe. But this was in 2003. So he came in and told me a lot of good stories. You know, I won't do them here because it would take off all the show. But he's some real interesting information about people and history and stuff. But he didn't know anything about that ship because he wasn't old enough. I think he might have been like five years old or something like that, you know. So he didn't have any information about the ship, but you know, I'm gonna write about that just to hunt.
Right.
Because there's a bay. Antilla sits on a bay called Bahia Nipe.
Okay.
And most sacred Catholic shrine in Cuba is in the Basilica in Santiago. And the people who practice the Lukumi call it the Golden Shim. And she's housed in this, above the Pope and above Jesus, inside this Catholic church, right? So the legend about that is that there were three men on the bay and a storm came up. The three men, one was a European, one was an American, and one was an African, right? They were out in the bay, they were fishing, and a storm came up. And they were praying for you know, salvation, rescue from the storm. And you see this statue about 2 feet tall floating in the water. It's like the Virgin Mary with a baby, right? But it's dark skin.
Yeah.
So they retrieve it, and the storm subsides, and this is considered like a miracle, right? So this statue of this woman is taken down and paraded around town for different occasions and whatnot. And there's a little chapel upstairs. You got to go to the back of the church and go upstairs to this chapel. And there are a lot of artifacts in there, some from Ernest Hemingway. And there's a little toy soldier in there that Fidel Castro's mother put at that shrine for the protection of her son. And as we know, many times that they tried to assassinate Fidel.
Yeah, it had to work.
Something was going down. So that's, you know, that's my little inside track on the Black Star Line.
Yeah.
While Marcus was out of the country, he got charged with mail fraud because he was soliciting to buy shares. And, you know, the people messed it up. But, That's the personification of Cuchichago Lea mentality.
Right, you know. Right.
Go ahead.
I actually got a chance to interview Marcus Garvey's son, Dr. Julius Garvey, on my podcast a couple years ago. I'll share the link with you. Okay. But it was during the time he was trying to get Marcus Garvey pardoned. He was trying to get Obama to pardon him before he left office, but it didn't happen. But that was a real good interview because he went in on a lot of the fraudulent things that happened to get Marcus Garvey arrested and kicked out of the country and all those things.
Well, Garvey, you know, he was in prison in the Atlanta Penitentiary. And the band I used to play in, Phoenix Uprising, we got a chance to play in the Atlanta Penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
Can you still hear me? My video dropped out.
Yeah, I can hear you.
You can still hear me? Okay, I'm back.
Yes.
We played in Atlanta Penitentiary. Now, I used to work in the state's attorney's office in Miami, and one of my jobs was to go to the jail and to the bond hearings certain days of the week to see who we could get, who we could get out into the program I was working with, like a first offender type of thing.
Right. Right.
So, you know, I'm accustomed to going in the jail and hearing that door closed behind you, but I never heard a sound like the one in that Atlanta penitentiary. That place had gates on the stairwells.
Wow.
It was serious, right? I was like, this is a serious lockdown right here. But that's right. Where he was in prison, you know. I could feel the vibe just being in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Garvey was just, yeah, they mishandled him.
Seriously. Yeah, they did.
I'm trying to look at my phone
because
I got my notes in here.
Yeah. I tell everybody, make sure y'all read Marcus Garvey's books. So everybody who tuning in, go read, go Google all the books Marcus Garvey have written, all the books about him, especially books from black authors, and read up on Marcus Garvey. If you don't know about him, read up on him.
Yeah. Read anything you can by John Henry Clark. I don't care what it is. You can close.
Yes.
Point your finger, whatever it is, get it. You know,
that's my favorite historian.
Yeah. I'm gonna mention my man Douglas. Well, let me say something about the folk tales that I've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
That people who high, and when I do High John the Conqueror,
mm-hmm.
those folk tales come from a book by a guy named Julius Lester.
Right.
That is. That's it right there.
Yeah, I looked it up. Right.
Julius Lester, right. I want to give the brother credit. I think he's transitioned, but, you know, want to give him credit. I talked about his play Contribution the last time, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's got another play called Day of Absence. And this is a play about this little southern town somewhere, and it opens up with these two white guys sitting on the porch at a country store.
Right.
You know, they're just conversating about, you know, what kind of day it is, the heat, this, that, and the other. And all of a sudden, they notice that this black guy named Rufus, the one that passes by every morning, he hadn't showed up. They haven't seen him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what happened to Rufus? You know, and then the scene cuts to the phone company. It's back in the day where you had the operator that had to connect all the calls. You know, she's frantic. She's connecting stuff and talking to people, you know, like, well, you know, because people, the ladies calling in talking about the maid hadn't showed up, and, you know, the yard man ain't showed up, all this stuff, right? So the thing escalates to a national emergency, right? So they bring in the news media, some reporter comes in to interview everybody, and the mayor's, you know, makes this impassioned plea for all the black folks to show up. You know, he's holding up the mop. Oh, Thomas, don't you miss your mop? You know, and so you can mop them floors and stuff, you know, and Louise, don't you miss doing the laundry and the thing?
No.
You know? Yeah. When I thought about that, I said, I know one thing. When the washing machine was invented, it wasn't for the benefit of black women.
Right.
Right. So I just want to mention that because that play is serious. And one other thing I want to mention is this book right here. This is a novel, and it's called Carthaginian Honor Society.
Okay.
And the action takes place in Atlanta. Written by his brother Zoran Burnett.
Right.
And it's a Kuji Chagulia mentality oriented book. It's about this group of brothers. This organization called the Carthaginian Honor Society, and I'm not going to spoil it. I will just tell you that when they have their meetings, it is impossible to bug their meetings just because of the way they have their meetings. I'm not going to tell you what it is. You have to read it, or you can ask me later. I might spill it, but this book is a great read, man.
I'm going to have to read it. Then we'll talk about it.
Yeah. Carthaginian Honor Society.
Yeah.
It was a hope. Okay, now, getting close to High John.
All right.
That's
my story right there.
Yeah. there's a prelude I want to do to it.
Okay.
You ever seen this book?
Yes.
Soul on Ice, right? He's got a chapter in here called what's it called? Hold on. It's called the Primeval Mitosis.
Mm-hmm.
Primeval Mitosis. And he gets into some heavy stuff that I won't go into too deeply, but he's got this concept related to class society where he talks about the omnipotent administrator,
right,
and the super masculine menial, right? This would be on the male side. On the female side, you got the feminine and the sub-feminine or the Amazon.
Right.
Right. Now the people in the upper echelons of society, these the omnipotent and the ultra feminine, right? They concentrate mostly on the mentality, on the mind, to the detriment of the body, right? People on the other side, the sub feminine and the super masculine menial, is just the opposite. They have highly developed physiques.
Right.
A little slow up here. Right. And that, without going too deep into what he's talking about, that creates some kind of dichotomy where eventually the white woman gets put up on a pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
She's all frustrated because she's not getting what she needs from the omnipotent administrator.
Right.
What she wants is really the super masculine menial. Right? And flip that, super masculine menial is denied access to the woman on the pedestal,
right?
But the people who put the woman on the pedestal really don't care that much about the woman,
right? Right.
She's just an object. Look at Miss Universe pageants, all these beauty contests. That's presenting that woman in a certain light. I've been in two Miss Universe pageants. I've seen it up close.
Right.
You know, I was the first one I was in. I was the escort. I was the military escort to the first black woman to be a semifinalist in the Miss Universe. Her name is Sherry Crickey. She's from the Virgin Islands, from St. Croix. Right.
Okay.
But I was all up in the middle of that, and I was like, this is I don't know. Now, you know, Donald Trump used to own the Miss Universe concert.
Yeah, I know. Concert. I know.
You got to know what that was about.
Yeah, you know the type of dude he is. He's old predator.
You've seen him in pictures with Epstein, so hey, come on. You know?
Yeah.
So that's that ultra feminine thing that they're trying to project to the world that's untouchable. So they say. But in this High John the Conqueror story, John flips the script.
Okay.
On the whole thing. So
okay.
And this comes out of Julius Lester's book, right? So, I'm gonna read it because that's the only way I can get it out really right.
Right.
I caution you that it does have the N word, but I'm about historical accuracy.
It's fine. That's so, fine.
Yes, this is just how the literature is written, right?
We want accuracy right here.
I'll give a little background on High John, and then we're gonna go into this little situation he had with his master. Now, what Master didn't know was that John was a conjure man. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, my picture dropped out. Let me start that again. Now, what Master didn't know was that John was a conjure man. I mean, John could conjure anything. John could cast spells, and he could cast them away. He could tell when a man was going to die and a baby be born. He could tell when a woman was doing what she wasn't supposed to, and a man was doing what he wasn't supposed to. And if John had a good reason, he could make the birds sing at midnight and the dew fall at noon on a hot summer day. High John was so famous that they even got a root named after him called the John the Conqueror root. And it's the most powerful root there is. Only thing more powerful than the John the Conqueror root is a black cat bone. And John had one of them. Now, one day, Master just happened to be talking to another slave owner. I got a nigga on my plantation that can whoop any nigga in the world, the slave master said. Can't whoop my nigga John. I got $25,000, say he can't, said the other slave master. It's a bet, John's owner said. We'll have the match in town a month from today. Master couldn't wait for that match. He knew that John was probably going to get killed, and Master didn't mind losing $25,000 for the pleasure of seeing it. Well, the news spread around the state quicker than hoof and mouth disease. It was going to be a match between the two baddest niggas in Mississippi. All the white folks was planning on coming. The governor had announced he was coming and bringing his family. White folks didn't like nothing better than to see two niggas in the ring fighting each other until they both fell out. Well, the day of the match came and white folks were there from everywhere. There were white folks there from Hang a Nigga, Mississippi, and there were white folks there from Cut a Nigga, Alabama, and Georgia, and New York. The lieutenant governor, the sergeant governor, and the corporal governor and his family. There were so many white folks there, it looked like a lynching party. About an hour before the match was to start, in come the plantation owner with his nigga, Andy. Now let me tell you, this was one big nigga. He was so big and strong, they had him tied with chains. He was snorting and growling and carrying on, so that they had to chain him to one of the pillars of the courthouse. He was so big that he had to stoop down at night to let the moon go by. Four white ladies fainted when they saw him. When John's master saw him, he began to feel sorry he had made that bet. He looked at that nigga Andy and could just see John pulverized. John deserved a good beating, but nothing like what he was going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about 10 minutes before match time, in come John. And John was dressed like he was going to his own funeral. I'm going to show you what he looked like. Look at that picture. I got a picture of him. Let's see here. There he is. Come on. This is what they depict him as looking like when the picture
came. Okay. Back. Okay, I've seen that picture.
Come on, come on. Yeah, there he is.
Okay.
He was going to some funeral. He was clean. Had him a pair of black patent leather shoes with spats. Some red trousers with a red coat, a white shirt, and a black string top. Over his arm was a hand-carved cane studded with diamonds. He was wearing a Stetson hat and walking real slow. Tipping his hat to everybody, John Diddy bopped down the aisle speaking to all the white folks. How you do, boss? It's good to see you. Haven't seen you since you sold my mama. How you do, sir? Last time I saw you was the time you whipped my sister and rubbed the cuts with vinegar. That was a keeper from getting locked, y'all. John was as polite as he could be, a perfect gentleman. After John had finished greeting all the white folks, he stepped out and went. He pretended like he hadn't even seen Andy.
Mm-hmm.
Who was snorting like he swallowed a box of snuff. John looked around until he spied the governor and walked over to him as fast as he could go, looking mean, mean, mean. John crawled over the governor's wife, stepped on the governor, and hauled off and slapped the governor's daughter. Pow! He hit that white girl all upside the head. He hit that girl so hard that her blonde hair turned brown. He hit her so hard, she was cross-eyed for the rest of her life. Pow! He smacked her again. Girl, didn't I tell you to stay at home and not come out here today? What do you mean disobeying me? Pow! He smacked her one more time. Well, when that nigga Andy saw John hit that white girl, he started getting away so fast that he pulled the courthouse down, broke his chains, and from what I heard, he ain't stopped running until he got to Canada. And Andy knew he couldn't whoop John, because if John was bad enough to slap a white woman, John was bad enough to whoop him. The white folks were kind of upset about John slapping that white woman until they realized that he simply outsmarted them. Uh-huh. Then they fell out laughing, especially the ones who had bet on John. Massa wasn't mad because the governor's daughter had said one time that his son wasn't good enough for her to marry. But the governor was kind of ticked off until old Massa slipped them half the $25,000, at which point the governor told his daughter to shut up all that screaming and hollering. himself, right? So back to what Cleaver was saying.
Uh-huh.
Right? That dynamic that went on when he slapped that girl. You know, everybody was a little concerned until they thought about the money.
Right.
Right? The economic game. Girl right. don't matter.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Right. right. Girls are significant. Right? Thus, yeah. now we have me too, you know, and stuff like that. Because, you know, those women are finally waking up to the fact that they don't matter.
You got know? People laughing in the comments. So yeah,
yeah, that is, man, funny. Yeah,
the psychology though. That's the psychology behind that. But also, I like to have, like, when I'm having a conversation with some of my friends, and we're talking about the different dynamics that go into white supremacy. And like the power dynamic between the white woman and the white man. And like you're saying, the white man has done a good job of using the white woman as his as a tool to get what he need, basically.
Exactly.
And when white women realized that white men did all this conquering and they didn't get their fair share, that's when you had the friction between them two, because the white man has always been abusive and violent to his woman. If you look at history, they've always been that. And that's part of that culture. But then when white women realized that they wasn't getting their cut of that power, that's when you saw a lot of the strife and a lot of these different movements coming around.
Yeah. Think about during slavery times. Right? Master could be all over the slave quarters, and the wife could be mad as she want to be, but she ain't ready to give up all that luxury and all that high life. You know what I'm saying? In Louisiana, I didn't even have this on my list of things to talk about. They had a system called plissage. If you've seen the movie Feast of All Saints, I think it was on either HBO or...
I haven't seen that.
Check that out. Feast of All Saints. Everybody's in it. Ozzie Davis, okay. Ruby Dee, any black actor from the 80s or whatever's in it. Go ahead.
Could you say the name of the book with High John the Conqueror again? That was sold on ice.
No. The High John the Conqueror story is in Black Folk Tales by Julius Lester. That psychological analysis I was talking about, the super masculine and the ultra feminine. That's the concept that Eldridge Cleaver wrote in his book, Soul on Ice.
Okay. So Jessica is in the comments asking about the books. I got you. Don't even worry about it. I got you on these books. You're on these books. I got a book list for you. So we're going to talk. I got you.
Yeah. I can send you one that you can, you know, put out whatever. Yeah, I'll just itemize all my stuff and I'll send it to you in an email.
Okay.
I lost my thought.
Yeah, I did too.
it'll come back. I was talking about the psychological dynamic.
Okay, going back to that.
That's kind of built into them, you know. I was talking about the master and the running around the slave quarters and the movie Feast of All Saints,
mm-hmm.
right? A system called plissage, It is the basis of what we now call the debutante ball.
Right.
To me, debutante dog balls, where they right. introduce the young ladies to the community.
Right.
Cassage was a system where wealthy white men would come to a party staged by a woman who, I guess we call her a madam, you know, she had a little leisure house or something like that. She would stage these parties where these plantation owners, slave owners and whatnot would come and negotiate deals for the young women, and they'd make negotiation with the girl's mother or whoever her guardian was. It was a financial arrangement. Papers were signed. Part of the contract included the guy had to provide a living space for the woman in the city, you know. And these women were generally a little above the lowest class of the society. They had a little status, right? So this movie is about a guy that had promised his woman he got through this plissage system. They had a son, and he had promised his son that when he got of age, he was going to send him to France to be educated. And he reneged on that, and then a whole bunch of other stuff. But, you know, but it's a great movie to examine that particular system of plissage. Right. But that's the foundation of the debutante ball.
Right.
What else do I want to talk about? Oh, there's... The Civil War. There were two Confederate capitals that were never captured during the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Austin, Texas, and the other one was Tallahassee, Florida.
Okay.
Right? So, you know, in my way of thinking, since I live in Tallahassee, I'm still living in the Confederacy.
Well, I try to tell people all the time that, you know, this part of Florida, like this part of North Florida, Tallahassee, this is no matter how liberal it comes off, it has them conservative and them extra racist lineage that helped build Tallahassee. Because it was slave plantations all over here. So
there were more slave plantations per square inch in this area than there were anywhere else in the country.
Right.
Plantations all over the place.
Right.
One right behind Tallahassee Memorial Hospital, Goodwood Plantation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tourist. You can go have a wedding there if you want to.
Yeah, I've been in there.
Goodwood. And there's more out west of here. You know, way out Tram Road. What's that? Yeah, way out. You know. There's some more out there going to a Lloyd and those areas that way.
So,
go ahead.
No, I'm just because now you got. I'm interested, like now, because we were talking about Natural Bridge Road. I've been in Woodville and I've driven down Natural Bridge Road to a point to where I saw like a horse ranch or something, but. You have a battle of Natural Bridge Road. What's that?
Yeah, Natural Bridge. That battle took place in Woodville, right? And there's a Confederate monument. It's maintained by the Daughters of the Confederate. That's on or near the site where that battle actually took place.
Right.
There was an attempt made late in the war. This happened. In March of 1865, March 6, 1865, which was maybe a couple of months before the war actually ended. I think the war ended in late April or something. But the Union Army tried to sneak into Tallahassee through the back door, like coming in from the south. They sent the United States Colored Troops, two regiments of the, I think one was the 99th, and I don't remember who the other one was, but two regiments of United States Colored Troops sailed to Key West. They went to Key West, or they sailed from Key West up to St. Mark's.
Right.
Right. And they had cannons and artillery, ammunition, you know, cannonballs, all of this, but they didn't have any horses.
Uh-huh.
So when they landed at St. Mark's, they had to hand carry all of this equipment more than 8 miles to get to down the bridge. Now, they had a skirmish before they got there.
Mm-hmm.
They burned the city of Newport to the ground, which gave them time to get the alarm to the people further north.
Right. Right?
If I can find this document I have about it, the Confederate forces were made up of farmers, a couple of militias. I think one of them was from somewhere in Georgia, even students from the school that became Florida State.
Mm-hmm.
Came to defend that Confederate position. The ROTC at Florida State is one of, I think, only two university ROTC units that has a battle flag.
Right.
Which indicates they have actually been in a legitimate battle during the war. Right. FSU has one of those. So anyway, all these people got a chance to entrench themselves at this location they call Natural Bridge. Natural Bridge is a place where the St. Marks River goes underground for a good distance, and then it reemerges, right? So it's literally a land bridge over the river.
Right.
The Union troops had to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
Right, they were outgunned, outmanned, whatever. But there's a guy in Wakulla County who wrote a song about Natural Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Ernest Toole. And okay. One thing I'll say, they have a commemoration of that battle every March.
Right.
And for years, you know, it was just the white people down there waving Confederate flags. But Ms. Altamise Barnes, who is the former director of the John Riley Museum.
Right.
He approached the Daughters of the Confederacy about, well, when you do this commemoration, you need to have a black presence, you know, because after all, those were black Union soldiers who fought here, you know, so they need to be represented in your commemoration. So they did something that I didn't think was possible, right? The museum is the headquarters of a contingent of United States Colored Troops, 99th Regiment, right? They have what they call reenactors who participate in these battle reenactments. So every year they go camp out for a couple of days at the site, set up a tent, you know, like the same way they would if they were really doing it, and then they go to the battlefield and they reenact the battle. I'll tell you one thing, you don't want to be close to a cannon when they shoot that bad boy.
I bet.
That's one of the things you ever want to hear, man. Scare you half to death, you know what was happening.
I see that in the football games.
Yeah, man, that's, I don't know how they did that. It takes three people to shoot to fire a cannon. You gotta have three people to do things, right? I'm like, dude, I don't want that job. But anyway, so they have a little ceremony and a little thing, a presentation is made under this tent. And so one of the United States Colored Troops comes up and does a presentation, you know, does a poem that was written about the Colored Troops. And then there's a guy who does a Frederick Douglass impersonation. And he comes and he does one of Frederick Douglass's speeches. And then he entertains questions from the audience, still in the personality of Frederick Douglass, right? I just used to sit back and smile at the way he wore those people out. You know, Frederick Douglass was eloquent. If you ever get a chance to read this 5th of July speech, when you hear people recite it, they're starting in the middle of it.
Yeah, I know.
You got to read that boy from the very beginning, man. He breaks down the whole American Revolution and how these people should be proud of, you know, how they attain their freedom and goes through the whole thing. He said, but none of that stuff applies to us. You know?
Yeah.
Oh man, it takes about an hour to read it. I'm in the process of recording the whole thing. I got one more section to do, and then I got to do some.
Oh, editing. That's good. Yeah.
But I'm putting the whole, all of it.
Yeah, it's a. Yeah, well, that's my annual 4th of July ritual to play it or read it, so I make sure people know about it.
Same here. I do too. I'll be putting verses from it on my Facebook and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, this is what we talking about. But anyway, I was talking about this guy who wrote this song about natural bridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's a white guy, but he did a pretty, I don't know, it's just kind of like a fair job how he handled the subject matter.
Right.
Well, I'm going to try to do it on my little kalimba here.
Okay.
So see how, all right, here we go. Head sailed up out of Key West town. Orders were to bring Florida's capital down. Blow all the rails and tear the salt works down. Rip up all and everything they found. Near the old lighthouse, the feds came ashore. We marched up that river 8 miles or more, looking for the place called the Natural Bridge. Crossed the river just below the high ridge. But they didn't know about the boys at Natural Bridge, and they didn't know about the cannons on that bridge, and they didn't know about the cannons on that bridge. Didn't know the price that have to pay trying to cross the same old river that day. Sorry, I read one line twice, but that's okay.
That's all right.
Rifles and cannons covering that bridge. There lay waiting high up on the ridge. 4 times sure the Union tried to push through. 4 times sure the Union lived through. And it was hell to pay on Natural Bridge. And it was fire coming down from that Natural Bridge. Cannonballs thunder and the rebel yell. Southern boys fired y'all and the Northern boys fell. It was just 3 months to the end of the war. Bodies stacking up, we all wonder what that. Count all the dead, the dying, wounded, and more. South won the battle, y'all, but we all lost the war.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That.
But you know that's see, people don't understand the bravery of them brothers that did that. They marched 8 miles dragging cannons and wagons and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, vanquished Newport. You know, they had to be tired.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
They still press forward. They still press forward. They charged twice. Says here that they four times they tried to push through.
Right.
4 charges. Come on now. These people were serious.
Yeah. They were. They were resilient.
There was another battle that happened between here and Jacksonville, right outside of Sanderson, Florida, or just on the other side of Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Battle of Old Lusty. Battle of Old Lusty. It's sometimes referred to as the Battle of Ocean Pond. Not far from the battlefield, there's a round lake. I mean, it's perfectly round. It looked like it might have been a sinkhole or something.
Right.
And I stumbled up on a reenactment there one time when they were doing the battle reenactment. Mm-hmm. My same guy, my same Frederick Douglass guy, was there too. He was there lighting them up too, right? But
right.
One of the other actors told me, he said, well, you know, this battle, I think the 54th Massachusetts. The United States Colored Troops Regiment, the one they depicted in the movie Glory with Denzel Washington, they fought Lusty, right?
Okay.
But there were atrocities, they told me, that were committed there, where prisoners were tortured. You know, some of them were executed, you know, without cause. I mean, just because you're a prisoner of war don't mean you're supposed to be executed, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, there was some funny stuff going on there. But, you know, just the idea of the people. But here's the thing. Here's the thing that and it's not really about the Civil War or any of that, but here's the thing that's critical about the Cujichaga Liga mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You go anywhere in the world, right, to another country. People are there running the country. They're doing what they do. They engage in international commerce, international negotiations, and all that. African Americans don't have that.
Right.
That's our handicap. That's our main handicap as a people. We don't have a country. You know, we're not in a position to take care of ourselves in every sense of the word. Right?
Right.
So we're still in a codependent relationship with our oppressors.
You know? Yeah.
And it's funny because a lot of people used to think when I was living in Miami, they thought I was Jamaican.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to have dreadlocks, but this is before I had locks. I used to play with a Jamaican folk group, so I was kind of steeped in Jamaican culture and stuff like that. But as far as I know, I have no Jamaican familial connection.
Right.
But a lot of people thought I was Jamaican. And I can tell you this, the response I would get from white people when they thought I was Jamaican was entirely different from the response I got from white people when they thought I was African American.
Right, right.
Whole another thing, man. You know,
right.
if they don't think you're an African American, you might not get the utmost respect, but they know you come from somewhere where everybody's handling their own business.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things I try to tell people about us African Americans, because we do have a history of fighting back, but we also have a history of allowing white supremacy to reign supreme. And they're like now. Right now, they'll kill one black person, and they know, white people know that there will be no real retaliation to it. So it's like one of those things, they're gonna keep messing with you until you do something about it.
Right, right. You see, a lot of times those killings are warnings.
Yeah.
You know, you're gonna kill this one, make an example out of him so that you don't act up like that.
Right. Know?
That's what a lot of it. I'll tell you something else. This is a story one of my uncles told me. And I mean, it's scary. My uncle said that when he was a young man, he used to be a custodian in this church, this white people's church.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he went there to clean up one night that wasn't his regular night to go because he had a date with some young lady on that night. So he decided to go to date early, right? So he's in there cleaning up, and he hears some commotion outside, so he ran up into the bell tower, and he hid.
Mm-hmm.
He said people staged a lynching in front of that church, in front of his eyes. He said he watched these people lynch a man. You know, he couldn't try to run because he would have been discovered and got lynched too.
Right.
He said he stayed there all night until daylight the next day before he left.
I bet.
You know? Well, that man, that rocked my world when he told me that. I had never heard that story.
You know, right.
He said he had never told anybody. Me and one was at a family reunion. One of my cousins had a video camera, and we just set it up in his hotel room and said, just talk to us about your life. And he came out with that story. Man. I can't imagine that.
You know? Yeah, I know. Like, and that's the type of trauma that black people been living with since first contact. I don't even like to just say since America, since first contact. Like you just got through, you started off telling us about Leopold. And so and we can even go back to the Greeks, and we can even go back to the Asiatics coming into Hyksos. Like black people have always been the object of desire from others, and we've always been looked to be conquered, and when we are conquered, they look to keep us, to keep the power, because you know a lot of people say that the new generations are going to end racism. And my thing to that is, so you mean to tell me white people gonna spend over 400 years to build this system of white supremacy, to just give up land, power, resources, and wealth, just give it up? Like, it don't work like that.
Right. Let me say one more thing about Leopold. When Leopold got a hold of the Congo, what he was telling the world was he was going in there to prevent the Arab slave trade.
Okay.
The Arab slave trade. That was his, that's what he said he was going in there to do, right?
Okay.
And the Arab slave trade is older than the European slave
yes.
trade.
Yes.
And it never ended. It's still right. going on.
Right.
It's not over.
We, you know what I'm saying? And you're right, because I tell 2,000-3,000 years old that Arab slave trade. And remember, like, what, 5 years after Gaddafi was killed, around 2013-2014, we saw the Arab slave trade live on social media. We saw people being trafficked. We saw those things. So you're right, like, the Arab slave, because we were victims of the Arab slave trade, Jewish slave trade, and the transatlantic slave trade.
Right. Yeah, they've been doing that to us for a long time.
Right.
Zora Neale Hurston interviewed who's thought to be the last survivor of a slave ship that was still alive in the year. A guy named, they call him Cujo Lewis.
But his name right. is
Chala or Kusala.
And he was
captured into slavery in 1857, 3 years before the Civil War started.
Right.
At that time, the slave trade out of Africa had been outlawed since 1808, since January 1st, 1808. There wasn't supposed to be no more importation
right.
of Africans. You could move people around slaveholding territory. We didn't supposed to bring anybody out of Africa anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But two guys in Alabama, in Mobile, Alabama, made a bet that one of them couldn't sneak in there with a cargo of slaves. And he managed
right.
to do it on a boat called the Clotilda.
Right.
So Kusala was only a slave from 1857 to 1865. So it's that eight years. Five, six, seven years, something like that, 8 years. But in the interviews that Zora Neale Hurston did with him, he was constantly, always talking about going back to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That was his mantra, man. Every time she talked to him, he was like, I want to go back to Africa. He called it Africa. You know, he had some children here. I think one of his sons was killed by the police in Mobile,
right.
you know, all that kind of stuff. He was like, you know, after emancipation, he and the others that were still alive that came with him, they were trying to raise money to get themselves back to Africa, and they never could get enough money.
Right.
So they bought some land outside of Mobile, and they call it Africa Town.
Yeah.
That place is historic. I need to get up there and try to put my foot on it, you know,
right.
stand there and see what I feel, you know.
Right.
But yeah, that whole thing about self-determination is
big. It's real.
You got to handle your own business.
You got to.
Yeah.
So, you know. Yeah. You know what? It looked like we're going to have to do a part three. That's what it looked like, you know, because now as we were talking, I was thinking, well, we probably do need to get together time to time and just come on and just talk some stories, talk some history, because it's a good vibe that we got going on. So we definitely got to do this again. I got to cut this one here because I know I got it's,
can
this.
I tell you one more thing?
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Yesterday, I was watching a debate that happened in 1965. Between James Baldwin and what's his name? The conservative dude. I can't hear his name. Just slipped me. This ultra conservative cat from the 70s,
mm-hmm.
right? And he was giving his comments. He said one of the issues he had with black people was this certain type of energy.
Right.
They were missing. When he said that, I said, he talking about the Coogee Cavalier mentality. He didn't have that term to use at the time because Kwanzaa didn't happen until 67. But when he says a certain type of energy that black people don't have, you know, he said that's what's holding you back.
Right. And yeah, we got to get it back. We got to get that back. That's why we got to do a part three. and like I say, it's a good vibe because people are learning a lot and people are enjoying the information that you've given. So, man, we might as well, we're going to talk more behind the scenes so we can keep this thing going. Cause, I want to make sure that I continue to use this channel to provide information to people that they may not be familiar with. So, Y'all, once again, make sure y'all subscribe to my Own the Souls of Giants YouTube channel. Make sure you like this video, you share it, you comment, put some comments, tell us what you liked about it. Tell us what you want to hear, what kind of information you want for next time. Because it's not just about us, it's about you all too. Want to make sure you're learning some things. So make sure you subscribing, like and comment, and share this video with a friend. Let people know about it so they can learn the good information that Baba was bringing. And we'll let you all know the next time for part three of Coogee Cavalier Mentality. But make sure you all tune in next week, next Wednesday. Next Wednesday won't be live, but I'll give you, you get the premiere of, The Word Storytelling and the Griot or the Jelle. So we're doing that Wednesday and Friday. We have the Geechee Experience. So we going in, and then, you know, we got to get Baba back on. So once again, Baba, I appreciate you, man. I appreciate just all the information you're giving and the willingness to do this.
Oh, my pleasure, bro. This is fun.
Yes, sir.
All this stuff in my head, and if I don't share it, you know, then,
We're gonna keep this going because this will be the platform. Oh, no problem. This will be definitely the platform where you got it. You can share it with us because I know my audience enjoy it, and I definitely enjoy it. So, I'll definitely be. We'll talk on the back end. So, let me go before I get in trouble getting to my next venture. But I appreciate you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir.